Europe is experiencing the largest wave of refugees since World War II and is desperate to find a long-term solution. Join America Abroad for a town hall discussion linking New York to Berlin on iTunes and PRI.org/America Abroad.
Stranded in Sharm el-Sheikh, this is The World. I'm Carol Hills, and for Marco Werman, investigators don't know what brought down a Russian plane over Egypt's Sinai Peninsula. Still, British flights out of the resort of Sharm el-Sheikh have been grounded, leaving thousands of tourists stuck in the airport and local hotels.
We just kind of got left to our own devices, and any member of staff that walked past, you kind of just grabbed and hoped they could give you an answer, to which they couldn't.
Also, the appeal of Western-style fast food in Iran.
We have these new shopping malls that are opening, and all of them have food courts.
And a Mexican court ruling that allows four people to grow their own marijuana.
They're really not stoners. I mean, these guys are doing this to make a point.
It's all ahead on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with support from Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide, with personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. You can learn more at Lumosity.com.
I'm Carol Hills, and for Marco Werman, and this is The World. The investigation continues into what caused the crash of a Russian airliner in Egypt's Sinai Peninsula on Saturday. All 224 people on board the plane were killed. Security concerns have grounded flights into and out of the Egyptian resort town of Sharm el-Sheikh, leaving tourists stranded. We'll speak to one of those tourists in a few minutes, but first, let's look at what might have brought down the plane. British Prime Minister David Cameron said today, "We don't know for certain that it was a terrorist bomb, but it's a strong possibility." Meanwhile, a State Department spokesman said the U.S. had not yet made a determination about the cause of the incident. However, he added, we can't rule anything out, including the possibility of terrorist involvement. Russia and Egypt have cautioned that it's too early to draw any conclusions. Jonathan Marcus is the BBC's defense and diplomatic correspondent. He says hard facts are few and far between.
Well, we still know relatively little. I mean, clearly the cockpit recorders, the physical evidence, the wreckage of the aircraft. Sadly, of course, also one must encompass in that the bodies and the luggage and the personal effects of the people on board. That is all available and is being studied. No clear indications yet from that, according to particularly the Russians and the Egyptian authorities. But of course, what we do know is that there was sufficient concern amongst British intelligence officials for the British Prime Minister, to Mr. Cameron, to actually halt all flights to and from Sharm el-Sheikh, which he did, of course, yesterday. Other countries have followed through as well. The Irish have done similar. There are French airlines not flying, German airlines as well. So we don't know the details of what might have been revealed. There are some suggestions, indications that it might have been chatter communications from IS-linked groups in the Sinai Peninsula, a very restive and uneasy part of Egypt. We can't say that for certain, though, but it was clearly enough to give the British authorities a cause for concern, and that's why they took the action they did.
And you mentioned British Prime Minister David Cameron. And he sort of said, made a remark that it was probably a bomb, which I'm wondering how Russia and Egypt are reacting to that.
Well, the Russians, the Egyptians basically think this is a premature judgment. They don't believe that there is clear evidence yet. It's interesting because just a short while ago, before I came to speak with you, I was watching the press conference between David Cameron and the Egyptian president, al-Sisi, who, as you say, is visiting London. In public, at least, it was a very friendly exchange. There are key strategic and security issues, obviously, the downing of this aircraft, but quite apart from that, obviously, the whole regional situation is high on the agenda. We've seen over recent months, particularly the Americans and, of course, Britain here now, basically trying to reach out and re-establish warmer ties with Cairo. And I don't think even the terrible tragedy of this airliner have really derailed that particular visit.
How about the always delicate relationship between Washington and Moscow? There's sort of tense diplomatic relations between the two at this point. And from what we're reading, it doesn't seem like U.S. investigators are getting much information from their Russian or Egyptian counterparts about this particular tragedy.
It is a curiously complex situation. So, you know, whilst you have on the one hand Russia intervening in the Syria crisis in a way which isn't seen in the West as being particularly constructive, clearly in other aspects of security matters, there is common cause with Russia. In other areas, of course, there is tension too.
The BBC's Jonathan Marcus. Let's get the view from Russia now. Reporter Charles Maines is in Moscow, and he's been watching the Kremlin's reaction to the idea that there might have been a bomb on board the Russian airliner.
Well, the Kremlin's saying essentially that it's a bit early to say. They're still starting the investigation. They're saying give it some time. I think all along it's been kind of interesting to look at the reactions here. I mean, obviously there is the outpouring of grief, and they're certainly on the surface saying all the right things. They're saying we want to get to the bottom of this. President Putin made a statement earlier this week saying he wanted a thorough independent investigation. And they seemed very basically happy with the work that they're doing, that the Russians are doing with the Egyptian investigators on the ground in Sinai. But, you know, at the same time, there's been this kind of unpalatable choice, I think, before the authorities, which is that, you know, either this is a failure of one of their airlines in terms of lack safety standards and things like that, or it's terrorism. And I don't think they like either one of those. But it's been interesting to see them sort of prefer the idea of somehow this is at fault of the airline. This is the fault of the airline rather than somehow kind of payback for Russia's air campaign in Syria against ISIS targets.
Yeah, I was just about to ask that. I wondered whether Russians, not the government, but Russians are asking, you know, gee, maybe a Russian plane was targeted and why. Do you hear that among the Russians you talk to?
Yeah, certainly. I think a lot of people are really concerned that this was somehow involved with or somehow tied to the events that are happening in Syria today. But again, I mean, the Russians, you know, essentially their take on this is, look, that the Russian official position is, look, we're going to do the investigation. We're going to see. And, you know, and again, on the surface, I think that's the right thing probably to say. But at the same time, you know, the kind of fix is in on Metrojet because they've already launched a criminal investigation probe. You've already seen sort of stories creep out in the press that the pilot's wife, one of the co-pilots had called his wife in advance of the flight saying that, you know, since he was worried about the condition of the plane and on and on. So I think the kind of push is that this is more an issue with safety rather than and problems with the airline rather than with Russia's government and their positions in Syria. Because I think this war in Syria, the air campaign that they've been holding for the last several weeks now, has been essentially, from a lot of Russians' perspective, kind of a quick good war. I think there were a lot of indications that they were trying to kind of put an end to this and sort of declare a quick victory. And clearly this is one of these moments that sort of pulls them back in further, if indeed this proves it to be true, that this was a terrorist act.
If it's determined that it is some sort of attack, has the idea of that kind of changed the public mood since officials have started hinting about that possibility?
Well, in some ways, yes. In some ways, no. I mean, we've certainly seen some cancellations of flights to Egypt. I mean, I think it's really important to realize that this was not, you know, these trips to Sinai Peninsula, to Sharm el-Sheikh and these resorts, this is not sort of the upper crust of Russian society. These were people, even just hearing about the first funerals today, you know, one worked in sort of a school cafeteria. Another person was just kind of an office clerk. And, you know, I think a lot of them people are starting to cancel flights. But at the same time, you know, I don't think you've seen a widespread panic. And there was certainly an awareness when the Syria campaign started that this was a potential risk. But they also expressed, a lot of Russians were expressing a lot of faith in the government towards keeping them safe.
Reporter Charles Maines in Moscow. As we mentioned earlier, many flights in and out of Sharm el-Sheikh have been canceled due to security concerns. Some airlines have said they hope to start flying again tomorrow. But meanwhile, thousands of tourists are stranded. Amy Johnson of Horsham, England is one of them.
We were actually in the airport ready to board. We'd been queued up by Egyptian authorities. They'd started checking passports, at which point, after about an hour of standing in the queue, they told us all to sit down.
That happened yesterday. Johnson says she and her fellow passengers just sat for about 7 hours.
During this time, we were getting no information from anybody. Nobody could give us any answers whatsoever. And we just kind of got left to our own devices. And any member of staff that walked past, you kind of just grabbed and hoped they could give you an answer, to which they couldn't.
Then last night, she boarded one of the buses reserved for stranded British travelers. They were on their way to a hotel.
We tried to sleep, but since last night, we haven't actually seen or heard anything from the British Embassy. We've been in contact with the general managers of the hotel. We've also tried to contact the embassy in Cairo and Sharm El Sheikh ourselves directly, but they are not answering the phones at either embassy, and we can't get hold of anyone.
We got in touch with Amy Johnson again just before we went on the air. She now says the airline has been in touch and that she may be getting home to see her kids tomorrow. But she'll have to board the plane without her luggage. Security is so tight that all packages, carry-ons, suitcases, everything is flying back on a separate plane. How do you say finger-licking good in Persian? Tehran residents got the chance to find out this week. A bootleg Kentucky Fried Chicken franchise opened up in the Iranian capital. Briefly.
We were going to have breakfast and it was too early to have a fried chicken. And then in the evening when I went there, it was closed.
That's Tehran resident who uses the pseudonym Bayzed. He says the fake KFC was right around the corner from his apartment.
Initially, there was a big Your Alphabet KFC outside. Then in 2 days, they changed the logo to the Persian KFC. But you could see the picture of the colonel on top of the menu. So it was a big shock to me that they closed it down.
And you say they even use the logo and they use the image of Colonel Sanders right up there in the wall. Clearly somebody in Tehran didn't like it. Do you know why it was shut down?
I think it's the power juggling right now in Tehran. Since the doors are opening, everybody wants their share of the pie. And usually this kind of outlets, it's not a matter of that people want it or don't want it. It's a matter of who will own the franchise or the master franchise. That's what I think.
Is something like fried chicken, would that be popular in Tehran?
Oh, yes, it is quite popular. And you really don't have to bring the chicken from outside. We have our own chicken, so you just have to bring the recipe and spices. Fast food is quite popular. After the regular kebab, which is no Iranian can live without a kebab, sandwiches are next, and then there are pizzas. These kind of things are developing everywhere. So we have these new shopping malls that are opening, and all of them have food courts. There was like Star Burger here, and they use the same logo. There was a Rose Burger here. They use a similar thing to Burger King. And there is a funny thing called Kamraniye Fried Chicken, which starts with a K. It looks like a Kentucky Fried Chicken. The initials are KFC, but it's Kamraniye Fried Chicken.
Since the U.S.-Iranian nuclear deal was agreed to, have you noticed any increase in Western-style fast food outlets?
Everybody knows they're all bootleg. The real businessmen are waiting for the bank situation to be cleared. And right now, we have European companies coming in and without getting noticed. So all the big hoopla is about the American companies. And also because yesterday was the anniversary of taking over the embassy, of the American embassy. And it's just a big hoopla. Everybody knows that who's going to be the partner of Halliburton next or the big oil companies. And this is, I believe, it's a show of force from different factions of the ruling class.
This is the kind of story that we have lots of fun with, but there's a whole serious side to what's going on in Iran these days. We read that a Lebanese American was recently arrested, as well as two journalists and two poets. Does it feel like, there's a crackdown going on in other sectors of Iranian life?
The crackdown is always going down here, but usually the Western media will notice it if there is an American involved. But this is also another adjustment in the power struggle.
Bayzed, not his real name. He lives in Tehran. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
A look ahead to a story we've got coming up in a bit. It's about an ancient yew tree in Scotland. This yew may be old and a bit lonely, but it's not set in its ways.
If you can imagine a very isolated tree, the only way that it could reproduce via seed is if it could produce both sets of reproductive structures and it could self-pollinate.
More on that coming up here on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with support from Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide, with personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. You can learn more at Lumosity.com.
I'm Carol Hills, and you're listening to The World. A single woman opting to have a child, it's not that big a deal here anymore, but it's still rare in places like the Middle East. Here's a story about a woman in the United Arab Emirates who did make that choice. Her name is Aisha Elbousmate. She's 49 and works for the government, and she's a single mom. I'll let reporter Amanda Fisher take the story from there.
Albus Mate is at the vanguard of a small but growing number of Emirati women over 40 who are single and have chosen to adopt.
I've done a lot in my life. I wrote films.
Albus Mate says she never consciously rejected getting married. It just didn't happen.
I did not put any rules in my life, you know, to get married, not to get married. It happens like this, you know. I didn't find the right person. But the issue that I find that I'm missing is the kid.
But having a kid outside of marriage isn't easy here. The United Arab Emirates is a deeply traditional Muslim country with large families, and many Muslims believe it is haram or forbidden to adopt. Though Albus Mate insists that's wrong.
It's never been haram, and Islam encouraged embracing.
Albus Mate is quick to point out that adoption has gone on in Emirati society for generations, though usually in secret.
Actually, adoption here is not something new, but talking about it is something new.
And Albus Mate is talking about it openly. 3 years ago, she adopted a girl named Reem. Her daughter is now 5 years old.
This is my secret tent. Only I can only whisper anything in mommy's ear. Yeah. It's a secret tent.
It's inside this tent that her mother told her she was adopted.
I was with her in the tent. She called me and she said, "I have a secret. I love you, mommy." And it was really touchy. And then I changed my mind. I said, "I have two secrets." And of course, the first secret that I love you, mommy. The second secret that I got you from my heart, not from my tummy.
Albus Mate says talking to her daughter about it was easy. What worried her more was telling her mother about her decision to adopt. She says her mother surprised her.
I was surprised that she was welcoming. She always supporting me, but in this step it was something never been happened in our family.
Her sisters were less understanding of the idea.
In the beginning they said, why you go for adoption, you don't need it.
But Albus Mate says they now love and accept Reem as part of the family. Albus Mate doesn't want to share the details surrounding Reem's birth, but she will say her daughter was abandoned by her birth mom. The Dubai government estimates a handful of babies are abandoned every year, some on the streets, and most are believed to be the children of poor migrant workers who fear punishment under the Emirates' strict laws against premarital sex. There are now about 50 prospective families on the government's adoption waiting list, and almost a quarter are single women over 40. That includes Albus Mate. She's been approved to adopt another child, a baby sister for her Reem.
I believe that she's somewhere there waiting for us, and this match will happen, inshallah, soon.
For The World, I'm Amanda Fisher, Dubai.
It's clear that some Muslims see adoption as haram or forbidden, but the mother we just heard from in Amanda's report insists it's not. So which is it? For some clarity on this, we contacted Natana DeLong Ba. She's an assistant professor at Boston College and editor-in-chief of the Oxford Encyclopedia of Islam and Women. I asked her, is there adoption in Muslim countries?
I think the best answer would be that it's different from what it is in the West. Adoption in terms of taking on the family name and being considered a full heir with the right to inherit from the family is not permitted in classical Islamic law. It's believed that it's very important for a child to always know who their biological parents are and to be able to trace back to their actual family heritage. But foster relationships in which a family would take a child in and provide for that child and raise that child within their own home certainly is known and has been practiced historically.
And is there a name for that?
So this foster relationship would be called kafala.
Yeah, in the case we just heard about, Aisha says that Reem is her daughter, but will always retain her birth name.
That's correct.
Is there any pressure to change the definition of adoption and get away from the kind of more sort of fostering relationship or the prohibition against taking the adoptive family's name in Muslim countries? Any Muslim country that you know of?
Overall, I would say no. I think the first initiative that's been made has been in the United Arab Emirates with the Dubai Community Development Authority.
So it's something that across the board, however observant you are as a Muslim, there's kind of collective agreement that the way it's defined and carried out is acceptable?
As far as adoption by changing the family name, yes. There is one other thing I should mention, one other option for kind of working around the law, and that is in the case of an infant who is under 2 years old to become a milk child. So if you are a fostering family and an infant is presented and the mother is able and willing to nurse that baby, if she nurses the baby at least 5 times before the baby is 2 years old, that creates a special relationship under Islamic law, in which that child is then considered a legitimate child within the family and is able to inherit and is actually also able to serve as a guardian or mahram for the mother.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah. And again, unfortunately, we don't have statistics available on that, but that practice has been known since the lifetime of the Prophet himself. He actually was wet nursed by a lady named Halima for the first 2 years of his life.
In any Muslim country, there has to be unwed mothers, orphans created for any number of reasons. What happens to these kids? Is there a stigma against them their whole life? What commonly happens?
I think it would depend on whether any of the circumstances are known about why that child had become orphaned. In a case where, let's say, the parents have been killed in a car accident, the child has lost their parents, the hope would always be that an extended family member would take them in, but there would not be any social stigma in that case. Social stigma might be more likely to occur in a case where parentage simply isn't known, if you have a baby who's abandoned. There are babies who are abandoned either by unwed mothers because there's a social stigma against sex outside of marriage. In some countries, it's actually illegal. So if you're found to be pregnant and you're not married, you could be facing criminal prosecution. In some cases, you're dealing with instances of rape or incest. So women will typically hide those pregnancies and then abandon the babies.
Do Muslim countries ever find themselves being criticized by non-Muslim countries about their definition of adoption and how it's practiced?
Yes. For many approaching it from a Western perspective, and I'd say this is particularly the case in the United States because half of all global adoptions actually occur in the United States, it seems that there is a double standard. And that double standard would be, on the one hand, Islam strongly encourages acts of charity, and on the other hand, adoption is prohibited. So it doesn't seem to make sense that adoption would be an incredible act of charity. At least from our perspective, you'd be taking in a child who doesn't have means provided for him to or her to survive, but that would seem to be blocked in this particular instance. And I think if there were more conversation that wasn't just focused on Western definitions of adoption, but also introduced kafala into the conversation so that we're also talking about foster relationships, that we might be able to find a little bit more common ground to work on.
Natana Dalong Ba teaches at Boston College, and she's the editor-in-chief of the Oxford Encyclopedia of Islam and Women. Thanks, Natana.
Thank you.
Coming up a bit later in the show, an Indian rocker who sees her music as a ticket to personal and financial freedom. That's here on The World. I'm Carol Hills. In Scotland, there stands an ancient yew tree, and it's just done something that's baffling botanists.
With the yew tree, the normal situation is the trees are either male or female, and when you get both genders on one tree, it's odd and unusual.
I'd say so. Find out more about the yew tree ahead on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International and by Soundworks.org, a collection of podcasts from PRI with global voices and perspectives. From Studio 360 to America Abroad, explore and subscribe at Soundworks.org.
I'm Carol Hills, and for Marco Werman, you're listening to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. Smoking pot in Mexico may have just gotten easier. And in Scotland, there's a 500-year-old tree that just changed its sex. No, I'm not stoned. I promise we'll talk about that sex-changing tree in a few minutes, but first, marijuana in Mexico. The country's Supreme Court has ruled that Mexicans have a right to grow and distribute marijuana for personal use. But no one's going to start rolling joints just yet. That's because there's a lot going on in that decision. Deborah Bonello joins me now to help me unpack it. She's a reporter based in Mexico City. Deborah, what exactly did the court rule?
So the court granted an amparo, which is a legal tool here that basically defends the constitutional rights of people. So it's basically prosecutorial protection to four lawyers who are part of a lobby group who applied for the amparo. They want to produce and smoke marijuana for recreational purposes, and the Supreme Court granted them that protection. So it means that they now won't face any legal proceedings for the cultivation and consumption of marijuana. But it's a ruling that only protects those four people.
So these four justices at this point can grow and smoke pot for themselves if they want.
I mean, the people who were granted the protection are lawyers who are a member of a lobby group. And they're really not stoners. I mean, these guys are doing this to make a point, and they want to create a national debate around the issue of marijuana use in Mexico. And the interesting thing about the Supreme Court ruling is that the whole issue has been placed in the context of a civil rights issue rather than a medicinal issue.
Deborah, I'm wondering if there's support among Mexicans for this kind of first step toward legalizing marijuana because of the drug violence related to the cartels. Even if the drug violence isn't directly perpetrated by marijuana sales or trafficking, is there sort of a sense of exhaustion and sort of, well, let's try this?
I think there is a sense of weariness on the part of the Mexican people in terms of the drug war and what it's done to society. I mean, it's cost tens of thousands of lives. You know, at least 25,000 people have disappeared in the last decade owing to, you know, the campaign against organized crime that the government has been running. Whether most Mexicans see the legalization of marijuana as a solution to those problems nationwide, I doubt that very much. I mean, I think most of them know that the drug cartels don't just deal in marijuana, and they have other huge sources of income, you know, extortion, kidnapping, you know, all those other big revenue streams. So, you know, I doubt that nationwide it's perceived as the solution to Mexico's violence problems.
How do Mexicans feel about this court ruling? Is there support for decriminalization for personal use?
I mean, I think in Mexico City, you know, like in any other country, the capital is always more liberal. And here, you know, people were sparking up doobies outside the Supreme Court when the ruling came down. But there were also a lot of people outside the Supreme Court who were against it. You know, a prominent parents association told us that, you know, youth are already facing such a challenge here with unemployment and lack of access to education. And now, you know, her fear is free access to smoking marijuana is just kind of going to exacerbate the problems of youth. And you remember, you know, Mexico as a country is a deeply conservative place. Abortion is only legal in the capital. Gay marriage was recently accepted in four other states outside of Mexico City. So the idea that people in the provinces and parts outside the capital are going to embrace, you know, the legalization of weed smoking, it feels like a huge leap to me.
So what's the next step?
Well, if the Supreme Court rules on four similar cases to the one that it ruled on yesterday, in theory, you could have a wave of people now applying for the same legal protections to do the same thing. And logic would dictate that the more people do that and the more of those cases are ruled, the greater the pressure becomes for legislative change.
That was reporter Deborah Bonello in Mexico City. Our next story takes us to the border between Mexico and the U.S. Students there are in many ways like students everywhere. They wake up, get dressed, pack their homework, and maybe a lunch. But some students on the U.S.-Mexico border grab something else on their way out the door, their passport. Kate McGee from station KUT follows one student as she makes her daily cross-border trek to school.
It's nearly 7 a.m. and 19-year-old Arlette Burciaga has been awake for over an hour. She's in her modest kitchen in her home in Ciudad Juarez, Mexico, watching her mom count pesos. Her mom just got home from an overnight shift at a car parts factory, making $8 a day. She hands Arlette 3 pesos for the bus, 4 for the bridge toll. They hug and kiss, and Arlette is on her way. She starts with a 5-minute public bus ride to the bridge. Arlette lives in Mexico, but her school is in the U.S., the Lydia Patterson Institute, a private Methodist school in El Paso. She's a senior and could go to school in Mexico, but at Lydia Patterson, she can learn English. Before attending the school, Arlette only spoke Spanish.
The teachers just talked to me, and I was like, I don't understand. And it was very a hard moment for me.
She applied and got a full scholarship. So every day, she commits to a commute like few other students in the U.S. or Mexico. For Arlette, this daily trip is now routine, even though she knows it's anything but.
I don't think it's pretty normal. I think it's big deal to cross the bridge every day.
Things can happen like September 11th and the Boston Marathon bombings. Security tightens and lines get longer. And like a normal high schooler, she can forget things, like her passport. She gets off the bus, walks to the toll booth at the bridge, and waits in line. Now it's 7:10 a.m.
Today, there is a lot of line. I don't know why, but we need to get in the line.
Once through the turnstile, she walks across. So now where are we?
We are in the beginning of the bridge.
And what does it say there on that sign?
Feliz viaje.
What does that mean?
Happy trip or something like that.
At the other side, Arlette goes through customs. Today, the customs line takes 30 minutes. Usually, there's a faster, separate line for students. Today, it's closed. But Arlette has company. 70% of the students at her school cross the border daily. Some are U.S. citizens who live in Mexico. Others, like Arlette, are Mexican. In line, Arlette talks to her classmate, Vicky.
Es injusto que nos agarró y no tenemos tantos oficiales.
Vicky complains about the wait while Arlette tries to figure out if another line is moving faster. In front of them, a man is pulled aside. The agent checking passports takes him to a separate room.
Maybe he doesn't have the required documentation. He's suspicious, I think.
Then an agent checks the student's passports.
A la escuela.
Where are you going? School, they say. The agent waves them through. It's 7:45 a.m. Once in El Paso, Arlette is on her own. Her mom doesn't have a passport, so if something happens to Arlette here, her mom can't come and help. 10 minutes later, Arlette reaches her school. She heads to the cafeteria. There's free breakfast and lunch. Nearly all of the students at the school go to college. The school helps them navigate the admissions process and get scholarships. Socorro De Anda is the president of Lydia Patterson. She says a college degree can change Arlette's life and her family's.
We've seen many, many families being pulled out of poverty because one child has gone through here.
Finally, it's first period, 8:30 a.m. It's been 3 hours since Arlette woke up. She says the commute is exhausting, but worth it.
I think it is a blessing of God to my life, because it gave me the opportunity to learn a new culture, the American culture, to new experiences in my life.
Arlette is hoping for college next, but it's unclear where. She hopes it's in the U.S. If so, she can leave her passport at home. For The World, I'm Kate McGee at the Texas-Mexico border.
Time to talk about a tree. But not just any old tree. This is the Fortingall Yew, and it's considered one of the oldest and most famous trees in Britain. As if that wasn't enough, this yew's story just got a little strange. It may be undergoing a sex change. Max Coleman is a botanist at the Royal Botanic Garden in Edinburgh, Scotland. That's where the famous yew stands. I started by asking Coleman just how old this tree is.
Well, the estimates vary from about 3,000 to in excess of 5,000. And the one that you'll frequently see if you look online, around about the region of 5,000 years, seems to be sort of widely reported, but it can't be confirmed.
Well, it's old in any case. Even a couple thousand years is pretty darn old. What does this yew look like?
Well, in Britain, we're very fortunate to have quite a good number of these ancient yew trees. And some of them are really rather impressive trees. They're not particularly tall, so compared to some of your real giants that you have in America. They're really quite small trees, but they do have these very impressive girths, and sometimes the branches sweep right down to the ground and even root and then throw up new shoots, and you get these kind of huge patches that essentially is one individual tree. In the case of the Fortingall yew, it's, to be honest, a bit of a shadow of its former self. It would have once been enormous, and it was measured in, I think, the 1760s as having a girth of 56 feet.
So the big story here is that it appears that this Fortingall yew, or at least a part of it, has changed from male to female, and the evidence is these red berries. What makes the berries female?
So the red part is all about attracting birds, because these fruits that are produced in yew trees, they're modified into these fleshy structures that are bright red, and they're there to attract birds to eat them and disperse the seeds, rather like a whole bunch of other plants have colourful berries to do exactly the same thing. So the trees in yews are either males or females. So the gender, if you like, is the same as in humans and many animals, that you've got male and female individuals, which is not the case for many plants, because it's often the case that you have both gender types on one individual plant. But in yews, they're male or female. Very rarely, the opposite gender will suddenly appear.
Now you say that the female part of these, the appearance of these red berries, what are the male parts of the tree look like?
Just now, at this time of the year, the male parts are pretty inconspicuous. They're still not fully mature, but they're small, spherical, greeny-yellow structures on the underside of the twigs. And when they mature in a month or so's time, they release clouds of pollen, and that pollen drifts around and it pollinates the female parts of neighbouring trees, and that's how you get the berries.
What would be the reason why this tree, or at least part of it, would suddenly become female?
We don't really entirely understand this. We know that plants have an equivalent system of chemicals to our hormone system, and changes in the balance of these chemicals will enable trees to potentially alter the gender of part or even all of the plant. So we know that there's a chemical mechanism at work. We don't quite know what the trigger for the switch in the balance is, and so suggestions have been made about possible environmental stress. We know in a few instances it's a kind of natural process whereby the tree might be one gender in youth, and then as it matures and goes into old age, it switches to the opposite gender. So that's a kind of predictable and normal situation. But with the yew tree, the normal situation is the trees are either male or female. And when you get both genders on one tree, it's odd and unusual, and we don't fully understand what's driving it.
Now, I know you've said you don't know why this particular yew tree, the Fortingall, has now sprouted female elements. But what do we know about why a tree would change?
It's possible that in the case of our yew, which would normally not have both sexes on one tree, there might be rare instances where there might be some kind of reproductive benefit for the tree. I mean, if you could imagine a very isolated tree, the only way that it could reproduce via seed is if it could produce both sets of reproductive structures and it could self-pollinate. And some plants are able to do this self-pollination trick. So that could be, you know, in extreme situations of isolation, that could be the only way to reproduce. And it might be that even when the trees aren't isolated, that just the occasional switches of sex can maximise the reproductive potential of an individual. So it could be a kind of strategy for long-term reproduction.
You're not going to let us get away with the idea that this tree is just tired of being male and wants to be female.
I think that's what the media would like to believe, but I don't think that's probably what's actually going on, no.
All right. Max Coleman is a botanist and the science communicator at the Royal Botanic Garden in Edinburgh, Scotland. Thanks a lot, Dr. Coleman.
Thank you.
Before we take a short break, a look ahead to a story we're working on for tomorrow. Journalist Gary Young spent more than a decade living and working in the U.S. Young's British and he's black, and he's got a unique perspective on racism in America.
Compared to other Western countries, what's distinctive is that American racism is more lethal because no other country has the number of guns.
A conversation with journalist Gary Young. That's tomorrow here on The World. And in a couple of minutes, the ethno-punk music of Trita Sinha. You're with The World.
The World's Global Nation education coverage is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, part of the American Graduate Let's Make It Happen initiative, supporting communities as they work to end the dropout crisis. AmericanGraduate.org.
I'm Carol Hills, and you're tuned to The World. It's going to be a big weekend in Myanmar. The Burmese are headed to the polls. It's the first election since the end of military rule in 2011. And when Myanmar is in the news, that usually means Aung San Suu Kyi is as well. She's the 70-year-old opposition leader and Nobel Peace Prize winner. A constitutional clause bars her from being president. But today she said that if her party wins on Sunday, she'll be the true power above the country's president. Patrick Nguyen is in Myanmar. He's a reporter with our partner Global Post. Patrick, what did Aung San Suu Kyi mean, and what's the constitutional clause that prevents her from being president?
The Constitution bars her from being president through sort of a backdoor clause. It says that anyone with foreign children can't be president. And that's meant to ward off outside foreign influence. So Aung San Suu Kyi has two sons who are British, as was her husband, who is now deceased. So she can't be president, and that clause in the Constitution is specifically put in there to prevent her from being president. What she's saying is, I know the country would like for me to be president. I know that you would like to elect me, and I know the military won't let that happen, but we're going to get around that anyway, and I'm going to be your real leader. I'll really be calling the shots, even though I'm not in the president's seat.
How did that go over? It's a little provocative.
Her supporters will be thrilled to hear that. You know, the military-backed party that's running against her, I think that they suspect that she's had this attitude all along. The military has very carefully prepared for this election. They knew that her party would probably be ascendant and would probably be victorious. So they put in all these contingency plans to make sure that they retain power. And by they, I mean the military.
Now, today, Aung San Suu Kyi also said that in this run-up to the vote on Sunday, things have been seriously flawed, and she hoped the international community would not be too quick after the ballots were being counted to declare it free and fair. What's she referring to?
This is not an entirely free and fair election. It really just isn't. There are parts of the country that are still experiencing warfare and people can't vote. There's a great fear that certain ballot boxes will be stuffed. And as I mentioned, there's that clause in the Constitution preventing the most popular politician in the country, perhaps the most popular person ever from Myanmar, Aung San Suu Kyi, from becoming president. So there are all these clauses that are built into the process that will prevent things from being completely open, completely free, and completely fair. And she's basically warning the public and the international community, brace for dirty tricks.
I read today that for the first time in history, Burma's Rohingya Muslims, there's about 1.3 million of them, they will not be eligible to vote on Sunday. What's going on there?
Not only will they not be able to vote, there are Rohingya parliamentarians who are currently in parliament. They have not been allowed to run for office. Anti-Muslim sentiment in Myanmar has gotten pretty outrageous. Political camps, including the military's pet party, have whipped up fear of Islam and this fear that Muslims are going to take over their country and erode the national religion, which is Buddhism. So you have very widespread fears of Muslim invasion. And this is very crass, but chauvinist Buddhists will often say that Muslims want to outbreed them and have more kids than them. This is really politically useful for the military's pet party, and they've even suggested that Aung San Suu Kyi herself is favorable to Muslims. So the Muslim issue has become huge in this campaign.
Now, the current president, Thein Sein, he was part of the military, and then the military government kind of took off its uniform and became a civilian government. Is there a chance he will win and continue to be president?
It's certainly possible. The next president will be selected by a very complex process that's a bit inside baseball. But to make it more understandable, the military still has a heavy say in who will become the next president. So, yeah, it's very possible that he will retain power. In most elections, you sort of know who the candidates for president might be, but this election is quite unusual in that there will be so much horse trading after the election, no one can even say for sure who the leader of the country will be. Even after the results are in, a process happens after that to select the president. That involves the military and the parties that have been victorious in the election.
Patrick Nguyen is a reporter with our partner Global Post. He's in Myanmar to cover Sunday's election. Thanks, Patrick.
Thank you very much.
Finally today, music from an Indian woman who's always known exactly what she wants.
I always wanted to be free and not depend on my father for pocket money or eventually my boyfriends or brother and that sort of thing.
That's Trita Sinha. She's the driving force behind Trita Electric. Trita Sinha grew up in Kolkata. She says the women around her weren't all that happy.
I had seen tears on faces of my aunts or mother or, you know, people, just teachers randomly in school. And that made me feel that something is not right.
Music, Trita Sinha says, was her way out, a ticket to financial independence and liberation. And that independent streak started at a very young age. Trita Sinha was only 5 years old when she started singing. She got herself through college by singing in Bollywood movies. But singing songs written by other people wasn't enough for Sinha. She needed to write her own songs and front her own band. That's where Trita Electric comes in. Sinha calls it ethno-punk music. The ethno part is a nod to her classical Indian musical roots. And the punk, she says, helps her express the struggles of being an independent woman in India today. The song is off the band's album Pagli. Pagli means crazy woman. And the songs on it tell the story of a woman who feels confined by tradition. But she breaks the rules and finds freedom, much like Trita Sinha herself.
To discover freedom, sometimes we need to go through very crazy moments or a tunnel of insanity sometimes to just realize what is freedom or how important freedom can be for our individual deep inner selves. And that really opened the door of my independent, musical life.
We'll leave you with one more song off the album Pagli by Trita Electric. This track's called Ranga Mari. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported by the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can, and the Candida Fund, furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet, the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Peter Berge in memory of Debbie Sitt, Cindy and Howard Rachofsky, and the Billy and Dodie Crockett Advised Fund of the Dallas Foundation, by the Ford Foundation, the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, by the Annenberg Foundation, Advancing a Better Tomorrow Through Visionary Leadership Today, annenbergfoundation.org, and by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.